Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. My name is Daryl Lynn Evans. I'm joined by my co-host, James Stiegel. Today, we're joined by a young adult fantasy author, Sydney Swanson. Sydney is an award-winning author of young adult sci-fi and fantasy, including the Rippler Trilogy and the Saving Mars series. Saving Mars was named to Kirkus Reviewer's Best of 2012 and was an honor book for the SCBWI Spark Award of 2014. When she's not writing, Sydney is distracted by shiny things such as books with raised foil covers, macaroons in jars, and stars set against an inky night sky. She lives in Eugene, Oregon with her husband, three kids, two cats, and entirely too much rain. Welcome, Sydney.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
I think we want to jump right into the Rippler, talking about the Rippler series. I'm a big fan that when I first met you at, I think it was the Booknest Authors Luncheon, you were talking about your the third book, I think, had just been released. And so I jumped right in into those, and I've loved them. And I what I loved about them is that while it's a story that of a teen dealing with this new, it seems like a magical ability to turn invisible, though there's a scientific basis in your story for it. The background is really set against a dark history. It includes the Holocaust and the eugenics movement, and it speaks about some contemporary issues today, the cloning and designer babies, and those kinds of things. I love how you wove in those really hard issues into, what we often think of as young adult stories are kind of, they're all vampires and and werewolves and they're easy. And I think you really deal with a lot of hard issues there. And I want you to talk a little bit about how you came up with that story.
Okay, sure. I think that probably like most writers, I've got an incredible amount of natural curiosity. And I will constantly be asking myself in daily life and as a writer, what makes someone do the things that they do? Whether that's, being a jerk in traffic or donating $10 million or whatever it is. I wonder what makes somebody do that. And so I knew I had to have a bad guy, right? Because I've got this story. And clearly, if somebody has a gene for invisibility, that's going to be a really hot commodity should any bad guys find out about it. Well, that was possible. So I knew I wanted a bad guy. But I think the thing that you always find yourself asking as a writer is, what does this, putting air quotes around a bad guy, think about him or herself? And the reality is that for that person, they are the hero. This is their epic story. Mm-hmm. And so I started asking myself questions about, well, so if I've got this guy who is, maybe doing experiments on children, what motivated him to do that? What made him think that this was not just okay, but something that he would actively pursue? And what goal is it that he's got in mind? And for me, it just felt really naturally right into to the eugenics movement of the early 20th century. Just kind of looking at how people had this idea that, well, you know what? We made the Santa Rosa plum. The Santa Rosa plum is the best plum that anyone has ever eaten. What if we could do that with people too? Why not kind of, cross and combine and take a look at what are the best aspects of humanity? And, going forward, we will only have Santa Rosa people or right, whatever. So, and I thought that was probably a pretty compelling argument for a lot of people at the time. And certainly I was able to imagine, my villain having thoughts like that. So that's kind of where it started, I guess.
Cool.
I was just going to say that issue certainly is alive and well today. It's not, we think of it as something earlier on, but with genetic, testing and, designer genes and things, it's definitely relevant. So
right, yeah, and that definitely kind of bled into some of my thinking as well. Mm-hmm. Started freaking me out a little bit the more I looked at it. It's like, oh, we could definitely go down this path again, couldn't we?
So speaking of the, go ahead, sorry,
go ahead.
Let me jump on. I was just gonna. So speaking of, coming from a scientific basis like that, how did you shift that into sort of a? Because the book definitely seems to, the feeling is it's almost like a magical ability that it begins with. So there's definitely some magic kind of world building that happens. And what do you think about the magic transitioning into science or vice versa, and how people's perceptions of that play into character?
Okay, so you know how Stephen King says that he writes for one reader, he writes for his wife. Mm-hmm. So I am in a similar situation. In the beginning, my stories are always first and foremost read by my husband, who just happens to have a PhD in physics. You can see how readily we came together, you know, writing physics. But what this means for me practically is I'm always thinking, oh gosh, this is sounding really magical, man. That's going to make Chris crazy. Oh boy, what am I going to do about this? So I may start with something that's quite fantastical, but in the back of my mind, I'm always looking for what's a way that, you know, my first reader, my favorite reader, is going to be able to swallow this. So I think things do kind of bend, not in every story I tell, but a lot of times my mind is kind of searching for, is there possibly a rational or semi-rational explanation for this? And that absolutely was the case with the Riddler series. I stumbled onto, I don't even remember how I did this, but I stumbled onto an article on psychosomatic numbness, talking about how body parts can seem to have no sensation. And as I was thinking about that, and then I started thinking about leprosy and how in that case, you can injure yourself and continue injury because you don't feel sensation. So I thought, well, that's an angle I want to explore. And the more I did it, the more excited I got about kind of this idea of losing your substance. So not just appearing invisible, but having no substance, which of course is incredibly unsafe. But you know, but I started wondering through, maybe there could be these genetic markers, and how would they show up? What might cause them? What might prevent them from showing up? Or bring them from dormancy to an actual state where you can turn invisible. So I don't know if that's much of an answer.
No, it is, and you've definitely got the groundwork there. Because my next question is actually about the characters and their emotional arcs. But I think the fact that you put so much thought into the world building just makes it like the foundation is there. You know, so that's really great to hear. And the next thing I was kind of curious about was in writing YA and interpreting these things. Like, how did you? Because it really seems to me like I've tried writing YA. I'm not good at getting the emotions down. I just accept that. I don't think like a teenager. Where did you feel that came from? Because it feels to me like you really get that roller coaster really well.
Oh boy, yeah.
And where would you say that was that something you developed? Was it something you kind of innately felt as you were, you know, this just felt right as you were working?
Well, the sad truth is that I probably, you know, still have a very active inner teenager. you know, I mean, for better or worse, I will say that before I was writing YA, I kind of assumed that everybody carried their inner teenager and their 5-year-old, you know, very much in the front of their thinking. And I have discovered that, you know, not everybody does. And so I'm grateful for that. Like I say, for better or worse, there is still a very accessible, very non-mature part of me hanging out in my head. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of will ask myself, well, how would I feel in this situation? And then, you know what, also, it probably doesn't hurt that I have been surrounded by teenagers for a while also. So, you know, just kind of look around. I know people talk about, you know, like walking into McDonald's and hanging out and observing teens, but I don't have to. They show up, chez moi. So yeah, that's probably an advantage too.
Mm-hmm. Did you, as the Riddler series is your first series, correct? That you published?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Okay. So did you know going in, I guess I want to ask about the technical side of that. Like it has the initial trilogy, and then there are the, I was surprised to see this because I had read that initial trilogy thinking that was the complete set, that there are 4 more books that follow, and they actually step out and follow a couple of the other characters who we met in the initial books. Did you plan that from the beginning, or how did that, you know, how did that work for you?
No, I so did not plan this. I thought I had one book, and then I kind of realized, I think this is going to be longer. This is going to be a really long book. Darn, I'm not writing epic fantasy. I'm in trouble. So at that point, you know, I thought maybe I had 2 to 3 books and worked on trying to find a place that would be at least somewhat satisfying to break that initial arc, you know, cover one part of my main character's arc and then go bigger with the other books. So I really thought I was going to be done. I told my readers I was done at 3. When people asked me questions about the lives of other characters, I said, well, you know, you go invent that because I don't know. and then I started on my Mars series, a different series, was going a completely different direction. And I was probably 1 or 2 books into that series when characters from the Ripple books started showing up in my head and having things to say, which is the point at which, you know, if they don't shut up, if my characters don't shut up, then they actually will get my attention. And these characters, they, oh my God, they really weren't at all. So then I started doing that, you know, fun dance between two worlds, and kind of I'd write a Mars book and then I'd go back over and I'd explore whichever character had been the noisiest in my head. And I mean, honestly, when I wrote the 4th book of the Ripple trilogy, you know, hat tip to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the 4th book in the increasingly inaccurately named Ripple trilogy. I thought that was it. I thought, okay, I've told Gwyn and Chrétien's story, and that was a story I was really interested in, and okay, good, we're done. But, you know, of course, meanwhile, I had introduced, I don't know, at least four other characters, 2 of whom were really interesting to me and who started talking and went in my head, like I said. So, you know, then I'm like, okay, one more book. This is a fun world. I like this world. I'm getting requests for it. And, you know, 1, book 5 and book 6 and book 7. And but I think I'm really done. We'll see, right? So, no, I did not know it was going to be a series.
You know, one thing that really struck me about the first Rippler book, which was, of course, I downloaded it for free. Like, it's available and read it, but it's so accomplished. Like, the fact that that's your first book, and it's just a very assured, and we leap right into characters, and there wasn't any of this arc, like, where she's, this author is figuring it out. And maybe we could, this might be a good question to start with after you read a little bit, but I would like to hear about kind of your, like, where you came from. Did you, because you jumped right into independent publishing, correct? Or had you
Yeah, I had been, like so many writers, on the query go-round for a while.
Right.
And I was seriously querying right as our nation's economy was tanking in 2009. So I was getting the full reads, getting lots of requests for fulls, and not, you know, not getting an agent, not selling at that time. Later I did, but nothing at that time. And so I thought, well, that's okay. I'll just go on and I'll write my next book and query that, you know, like we do. And then 2010 hits in 2011, and I started to know people who were self-publishing, and I kind of thought, well, gosh, I've got this book and it's in pretty good shape. You know, if I did a few more passes, just based on some feedback that I had gotten while querying, if I did a few more passes, I think people would read it. And so I just felt like, well, what do I have to lose? And of course, then jumping in as I did in 2011, it really was a very kind of a golden age of self-publishing. There was lots of things that worked really well for helping new author visibility at that time. So,
well, I think for any authors that are listening that are thinking about independent publishing, your series and the way you've done it is one of the best examples I think I've seen of the full package that if you hadn't said, you know, I think when I first heard you speak, you mentioned that it was self-published and I'm like, what? No. That this looks better than, you know, many you know, I don't think a small house could put something out that looks this good.
Oh, gosh.
So it's definitely I would recommend anyone check that out as an example. But why don't we, Darlene, do you think it's okay if we jump into the excerpt and then maybe we can talk about...
Yeah, let's do.
Okay. So do you have something you'd like to read?
I do. So this is not from the Ripple series, but it is a different standalone title that, again, you know, the character showed up in my head and would not go away. So this is from my newest release called Siren Spell, about goblins and ballet and Shakespeare plays. So here's the first page or two from that. Chapter one, Holy Mother of Patience and Deodorization. At 4:53 in the morning, it was hard for Giselle Petrovna Chekhov to care whether or not she might be drowned by Slavic sirens. It was hard to care about anything other than grabbing one last hour of sleep before the auditions at the family ballet studio began at 7. Twisting in bed, Giselle glared at her cell phone as if it were to blame for the early wake-up call. It was not. Downstairs, Giselle's mother, Ruslana, was arguing with grandmother about Rusalki, the name Russians had given the sirens of foul weather Oregon. Giselle sighed and fell back onto her pillow. Babushka, her grandmother, must have had another dream of evil portent. Giselle had a smattering of Russian, enough to piece together that her mother and grandmother were fighting about the ballet for which she had been named. Giselle. Babushka was warning Giselle's mother their upcoming production of the ballet would draw the Rusalki back to town. Global warming might drive them to town, said Ruslana, switching to English, or a lack of salmon or whatever they eat, but vanity isn't going to drive them anywhere. Babushka muttered something Giselle didn't catch. It's ridiculous to suggest the creatures are even aware of ballet, said Ruslana, much less that they have an interest in it. How would aquatic creatures know what we're up to? They live underwater. They know, said Babushka, her voice darkly threatened. And I tell you, they are driven by vanity. Why the gifts of combs and mirrors if they are not vain? Giselle's mother made a derisive noise. The ignorant and superstitious leave combs and mirrors, and old women who have nothing better to do with them. Giselle's babushka was convinced there was a supernatural component to the sirens' existence, as well as to their attacks on humans. Giselle believed, too, an even sensible, rational Katya, worried that the creatures might be something more than natural. Their mother didn't believe the sirens were anything but elusive and occasionally violent sea creatures with a humanoid appearance. Ruslana had never had a problem standing outside popular opinion, either within her family or without. So I think I'll break there.
Okay.
Wow.
So you've never wanted to read your own audiobooks, have you?
No.
You did a great job. That was great.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. You get me next to a real narrator and you see the difference. But
Well, thank you. I immediately want to ask, see, this is why we wanted to ask the Rippler questions first, because I immediately want to ask questions about, it sounds like you're tying kind of a Northwest mythology with a Eastern European mythology?
Well, definitely Eastern European. Now, if there is Northwest mythology around sirens, then actually that's something I get to go research and learn about.
I thought I heard Oregon. Maybe I misheard you.
Oh, yes, it is. It's the setting is in Oregon.
Oh, okay.
Invented a bucolic little tent northwest of Portland, mm-hmm. By Sobey Island, where these creatures show up every 10 years or so and attack.
Oh, okay.
Thanks.
So, what was the character hook in this story that really drew you into it?
Oh, golly. So I said it was a ballet story, which you don't get, you know, I think there's maybe the word ballet shows up twice in the first page. But that was definitely where I started. I was thinking about a dancer who was perfect in every way, you know, for a life dancing on point. And I was thinking about it down to her toes are perfect. She's got, you know, great feet, perfect arch, and all of these things that go right. And then, of course, as we do with our characters, throwing her a curveball and making her very tall. So if you're a woman and you're 5'10", 5'11", there's a good chance that you won't end up spending a life being taller than whatever, whoever you hook up with. But if you are a dancer on point, you're going to add another 7 inches to your height. Mm. So that means that for classical ballet roles, dancing with dancing opposite a partner, you have to either have a really tall guy in that company or you're screwed. Basically. So that's this girl's situation. She's very tall already. She's probably done growing, but can she actually have a career in ballet no matter how good she is? And so that is kind of the beginning of her personal crisis. And of course, that personal crisis explodes with this background of these dangerous sirens showing up in town.
Mm-hmm.
As the grandmother said, they're vain. These creatures are vain. And they're like, oh, cool. Somebody's doing a ballet about us. We're there. Oh, and look, they're doing a Shakespeare play about a evil fairy kingdom, too. We are so there. So, you know, oops.
I like how there's a tie to water in your work here. Is there does that come from something in your life?
Are you
also a water baby?
So I never thought about that. And guess where my other series is? Mars, no water, right?
Mm-hmm.
I personally, I love water. Absolutely. But I haven't thought about that before. Huh. All right.
those obsessions we don't realize we have.
Right. Yeah.
So I guess, why YA? Why did you choose YA to write?
Oh boy. Good question. So it certainly wasn't a choice in the sense of, there's lots of categories in which one could write. I choose this one. Instead, I would say that, you know, like the characters that showed up in my head happened to be 15. And so that means in terms of querying and in terms of traditional sales and placement, that definitely means YA. So it was something that I kind of fell into. But as I was working on that first character and her voice, I realized, wow, this is a place I'm really comfortable. I like it. I like the sorts of issues that come up at these places in our lives. And then when I did, you know, move on to knowing I was going to write more than one novel, because of us know that we're going to do that while we're struggling through our first draft, especially. But as I did start to think about it, I thought, you know, this is where I want to be, because when I was late middle school, early high school, books saved my life. You know, we all have that, those awkward couple of years there. Most of us do anyway. I sure did. And books were kind of what kept me going. Very, very key part of making it through those really rough years. And I thought, gosh, I wouldn't mind doing that for somebody else who's, you know, 12, 13, 14, and just needs a chance to get away, to maybe find somebody like a Tiffany. So once I made that connection, realizing this was the point at which books were the most significant, then I was like, oh yeah, this is where I'm staying here.
Mm-hmm.
So far.
Well, you know, they're always talking about when, you know, YA is over. YA is not going to, you know, and it just keeps, you know, you're right. That is the wellspring of where so many readers begin. And if you can reach, I mean, kids are outreading adults at this point. So
Yeah.
It seems like a great place to be. When would you say that you first really began writing? Could you talk about what led up to?
Sure. So by the time I was 7, I was completely sure what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to write books. And I was pretty clear that I wanted them to be fiction, because I did have teachers asking them, like, oh, no, none of that nonfiction. I'm telling stories. And so I did for many years, until kind of a watershed event in school. And then I had a long break. And wait, what was the question?
Well, let's say, when did you become serious about it? So
I think, you know, when I became serious about it, honestly, was kind of late in adulthood.
Uh-huh.
And I certainly had picked up a pen and started writing, but I'd never written my way to the end of anything. I just started lots of things without finishing. And finally, about 8, 9 years ago, something like that, I just woke up one day and I said, that's it. I'm writing a novel from start to finish. It can be the world's suckiest novel, but I'm going to get all the way through something, all the way to those magical words, the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I was finally ready to do it. I think I'd kind of gotten past the need for it to work and be good. And that for me was a key. I could go ahead and suck as badly as it needed to.
Was there anything that helped along the way? Were you part of a group, or did you have a mentor maybe? Or
I had a couple different things along the way. Definitely SCBWI, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, was a real and continues to be a real important organization for me. Just lots of practical craft information, and then tons of business information as well. Locally, Willamette Writers, fantastic group. Good for kind of giving you that monthly injection of thinking about writing and treating the craft and the business seriously. And then I've had live critique groups. I've had groups where we beta read for one another that aren't live, where we may or may not have, we're online interacting with each other. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of everything.
That's one of the neat things I think about that independent publishing makes possible, but also you can tie into these networks that you maybe couldn't have tied into before.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one thing I'm curious about is, because, you know, you also are wearing the hat of being your own publisher. Was there a learning process for that that went along with writing and being part of these groups? And did you get information from other writers, or how did that work for you?
Well, I definitely have an entrepreneurial streak, and nobody in my family knows where it came from because there are no entrepreneurs until me. But I, having said that, I had run a couple of businesses prior to independently published author. Mm-hmm. So I definitely went into publishing with kind of that idea that the business side is at least as important, that I really have to take good care of the business side if I want to have a business, because there is no publisher taking care of it. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be part of what you get with publication. I mean, although sure, it's, you know, less and less in terms of marketing and, you know, getting sent on tour and things like that. But just even the basic things of, you know, connecting with readers, capturing emails, and so that you can let people know when your book five comes out. So I was aware definitely from the get-go that if I don't do it, ain't nobody going to do it. So it's got to be me. And then I did stumble into some good information early on Kindle boards. It's now K-boards, I believe. Mm-hmm. And connected up, was invited into a couple of private Facebook groups, and, you know, started sharing information, what's working, what's not working, what books should I be reading if I want to know more about successfully marketing my books. And then at some point ran into a book by David Gogren, who's since become a friend. Fantastic pair of books there. Let's Get Digital and Let's Get Visible. Just a nice, good summary of kind of what the landscape is like in India. So those books were really
I love that. Let's Get Digital was, when did that come out? 2010 or 2011?
Oh, yeah, I think it must have been 2010 or 11.
And it still feels like it's making that argument over and over again. Why it is so, why it makes sense to do this, and people still.
Yeah.
But well, can you talk about so those groups? You know, obviously managing a creative pursuit as a business has its own challenges. So did you have to create systems for yourself, or did folks help you with, you know, once, okay, I've got a manuscript, I run it through beta readers or my own editors, where do I find people I guess what was your process to find people that you could trust to give you good feedback?
Well, absolutely. I hired out. I mean, I think that is the first thing you do when you don't know anybody. You know, you go looking for a good editor. And the great news for anybody considering an independent publishing is that, I mean, it's great news for us, it's actions at all. There are lots of editors who are out of work from, you know, traditional careers that had to let them go during that 2009 slump in our economy. And not all of them have gotten hired back. And so, plus, a lot of them now realize that they can have indie careers doing outside jobs. And some of them were doing outside work to begin with. So there's, that was kind of the first place that I plugged into. And then I have no idea how I ended up with the wonderful beta readers that I have now. I think I must have met them on cable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure.
Have you ever come up against like advice that you know, nope, this person's wrong, or has it always been?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, do you mean like in terms of
well, just that process. So like let's say go back to, you know, book number two, and you're still trying to figure out like what you can trust and not trust.
Right. Yeah.
You know, do I trust the beta reader, or the, you know, the books are still selling? So that seems like a hard point to figure out who you need to listen to or not listen to.
It really is. I mean, in the end, you end up listening to yourself kind of by default. One thing that is helpful that I've found is to set something aside for a long time. If I have a serious, you know, conflicting information from two or more parties, or if I have a really strong negative from somebody who normally I would trust, but I don't agree with them, I find it really helpful to just set it aside, you know. And if I can set it aside for several months, that's the best. Because at that point, I'm going to be looking at the manuscript, not remembering every sentence and how every paragraph starts and ends. And sometimes I will see, oh, wow, I see what that person was talking about. And oh, what do you know? They're right. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, time is absolutely your friend when trying to make those hard choices about, you know, what stays or what goes, or would my character really be this way or not? You know, have I made too great a leap of logic from A to B? So yeah, time is...
You know, speaking of time, have you, the way the market is right now, have you felt any pressure to publish something faster?
Oh, lots of pressure. I actually haven't published anything for 10 months now, which for me, I know that is might sound just fine. But for me, I do tend to work at a faster clip. Mm-hmm. And I wish that I were working at a faster clip right now. And the reason I say that is that I think I know it's true for my readers. They definitely are expecting something a couple times a year at this time, just because there are plenty of people out there who are producing a couple of titles a year. And I've been one of them. Mm-hmm. I've had insane years where not necessarily because they were all written in 1 year, but just because of, you know, the way the chips fell, I had 4 books come out within a year. So that's not a sustainable pace for me. And some of those had been in the 6 years. But you know, you generate reader expectation, and I hear from my readers, and they're all very curious what Sydney has been doing with herself. Well, so I had a flop book and one that I just couldn't write my way out of, and you know, and I am starting a series. I started that early this year, and so just doing all of that world building just takes time to get a new first in series together. So.
Mm-hmm. The one that you couldn't write your way out of, can you? Can you talk about that?
Oh, man, that was really mortifying. I am very accustomed to my own process, which looks kind of like this. I write a first draft and it's horrible and I know it's horrible. And all the way through, I'm thinking this is the most horrible thing I've ever written. It completely sucks. There is no possible way to salvage it. And then, you know, I'll have somebody else read through it and go, oh, I think you've really got something here. It needs a lot of work, but go for it. And then... you know, I'll do 4 or 5 revision passes. And by then it starts feeling like it's book shaped and I start having some hope for it after all. And then by the time I'm into actual editorial revisions, I usually believe that I can pull this off, do it until the book last fall. So I started what I thought was going to be a novella. I thought I would just write my way through it in a month. And then it got to be novel length. And then it got to be problematic. And then I was determined I would write my way through it because I had every other time. And surely this is just one more example of, you know, lack of confidence like I often do at the beginning. But no, I finally in like February, I just set it down and said, wow, I cannot, it's work. This is not making me. It's not something I want to get out there. I need to just let it.
Did you have too many characters or you weren't happy with the way the plot was going?
Yeah, it was, I think the issue was that one of my characters, I had not understood her motivations deeply enough to write her success. That's mm-hmm. at least that's my belief now. I probably will go back and look at it maybe, I don't know, another 6 or something and see if I feel like it's salvageable. But yeah, I just...
You typically write in about 60,000 words for a novel?
Yeah, 60, yeah. 70. Yeah, YA is... you know, 65 is kind of the sweet spot for YA. So
it sounds like as you're talking about this, that you're perhaps more of a pantser than a plotter. Can you talk about your writing process and especially, you know, like, especially when you're thinking about developing a larger work, how, you know, how does that work for you?
Right. Well, I'm not a pantser in the sense of I'm just going to sit down and write and it will all magically come to me. I mean, I actually have 2 friends who very much write every day, not knowing where it's going to go. I need to know where things are heading. I for sure need to know how the story ends. I may, in early versions, be misidentifying what the important part of a character's growth arc is. And I frequently misidentify it. And then through revision, oh, no, this book's actually about this, not that. But I like to know, you know, where we're headed. I like to have an idea of what is this character's, what is the flaw that is standing in the way of them being a complete and whole person? What is it that they're up against and have to overcome? And, you know, sometimes it does kind of shift and I'll realize, nope, it's about X, not Y. But I very much want to know that information ahead of time. And sometimes I'll do, you know, quite a complete outline. And then as I'm writing, of course, creative brain's like, I'm not going that way. I'm going this way. Bye. I'm like, okay. is that much of an answer, Daryl? I don't know.
I think so. It's just interesting to know, because especially like, I know Rippler was your first one, and you said you'd kind of looked at it as a standalone, and then it expanded, mm-hmm. and then it expanded again, and now yeah. it's really gone in. and then people keep walking, or characters keep walking back in. Was that the same with the Finding Mars series, or did you feel like, okay, I now know I'm going to, you know, did you start that one thinking, I want to do this as a series, and it's going to be X amount of books, or mm-hmm. now that maybe you have two series under your belt and you're looking at future projects, is it, you know, are you thinking, okay, maybe I need, are you shifting in your process there in terms of how you're thinking about outlining or planning sure, or those yeah. bigger arcs through yeah. through a series?
Definitely a huge shift between that first series, which I didn't know was a series, and writing the Mars books. With Mars, I absolutely knew it was a series. I had some ideas for three distinct arcs, which would fall under one, of course, larger arc. So I thought, well, it's at least three books. I'm sure it's three books. And and so I did have to know, I felt like it worked much better for me to know where book two was going and where book three was going to land before I got too far into book one. So with that one, I was much more kind of hard-nosed about, okay, this book has to end here because that gives a nice complete arc for this character or this aspect of this character's growth. And, you know, didn't want to leave things too cliffhangery, but on the other hand, wanted readers to feel motivated to move on. So there was a lot more thought that went into that series. And then in between, in between that and what I'm currently doing, I had a couple of standalones. One of them is out on submission. And then the other one was Science Velvet that I published. So I do still seem to have, you know, a thing for a standalone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm back into a series now, and it feels so good kind of knowing that, okay, I've got my little arc and then I've got my big arc. And I really like the interplay between those two and dropping some of those, the things that will become a part of the big arc, dropping those in early and figuring out which ones I'm not going to drop in because those are going to come in book two, you know.
Wow, how do you make those kinds of choices, knowing, you know, we are going to watch that character grow over several books, like, okay, here's how far she's going to go in book one and book two and book three and on. Like, what are some of the things you struggle with, or how do you figure that out?
Oh, boy. Do I know the answer to that? Well, I'm sort of cheating my way through it right now because in the current series I'm doing, I'm actually having a different heroine in each of three books. So they all get, you know, accomplished in one book, although I'm sure because they're friends. So how did I know it was something I struggled with when I was doing the Mars series, knowing that it would be a long series. It was so hard not to allow my character to grow into who I wanted her to be in book one. It was just like, nope, you know what? Human growth is slow. It's not instantaneous. It's really not. True change takes lots of time and lots of work and lots of failure, I think, really, before, you know, we experience change. And so it was hard not letting her grow up all the way, you know, by the end of the first or even the second book.
Mentioning that, one thing I've found really interesting in YA, or I noticed, is that sometimes what feels like withholding information in the character is that the character just, that's part of their growth arc. And do you find that difficult sometimes, where you want a character to be smarter than they are, or you got to write them to a certain capacity, and then, okay, I gotta stay here. I can't, you know, they're gonna make these dumb choices, and I gotta get the reader to buy that they're doing this, you know.
Yeah, and that they're not, you know, complete idiots, even though they're making clearly wrong choices. I think that's a real scary balance, because I am concerned that my readers will look at a character's choices and go, oh, you are so no way to behave like that. Even though we know people who behave like that.
Right.
So finding that balance between reality, what we actually know in people that we know or people that we were, finding that balance is, I think it's really tricky. I just kind of cross my fingers and hope I'm somewhere in the ballpark, you know, if not make it too crazy, but at the same point, allowing a character the slow growth that I think, you know, is how humans grow and change. Mm-hmm. Kind of slow.
Have you ever written short stories?
I haven't. I'm completely terrified at the idea of writing a short story. I mean, I did when I was a teenager. I don't know how I did that now. I'm like, oh my God, how can I say it in fewer than, at least give me 50,000 words to say it.
Yeah.
And like picture book authors. Oh, I have no idea how they do it. They have 32 pages and they can't put very many words on each page. Mm-hmm. It's like, go ahead and be a poet. You might as well. I mean, that's how hard it, each word has to carry so much weight. So no, I have not.
Well, I think it's a completely separate skill to stretch a character across 50,000 words, you know, so that's its own challenge and art. Let's see.
So, I guess just earlier we kind of meant, or I had brought up that the thing about water, something you maybe hadn't noticed in your work. Do you have some obsessions in your work or questions, you know, like your writer obsessions or questions that you are trying to answer with your work or a particular subject, themes that you're returning to? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't in terms of me being consciously aware of them. I can tell you what some people, readers have pointed out. You just pointed out the water. Apparently, I'm really big on exploring forgiveness. So who knew? But my readers have pointed that out to me, that I've got a couple of books where I'm really exploring what does it mean to either extend forgiveness to someone, to have it extended to you, or maybe, you know, hardest of all, to forgive oneself for something that you have done that you regret. So apparently, you know, that's something I'm really into because it shows up in a couple of places. I think I'm just kind of blind to that, unfortunately, or you know, well, for better
maybe fortunately.
I don't know.
Don't make it too heavy-handed in there.
Yeah, you know what? Maybe that's. I think that could be the flip side. If you're very self-aware, you know, does that make you didactic? I don't know. That would certainly be something I would be really scared of, just because teenagers are the best. They have the best bullshit detectors of anyone. So, so maybe that's why I don't think about it. I'm afraid of, you know, starting path getting real preachy or something. I don't know. Or I'm just not very self-aware.
I do appreciate in there that you have these very strong young women who are self-actualized and have full subjectivity and are making their way through the world. So I do appreciate that as a piece of your work, that that your character, your women, your young women are very strong. So I like that they're going to be good models in that way for readers.
Thank you for noticing. I guess that would be something that's super important to me on a very personal level. You know, we've got the own voice and it's not something new. All of us, many of us have those moments where we wonder, am I the only one like me for whatever reason? And of course that comes in varying strengths and with hugely different amounts of, you know, the way that it affects us personally. But when I was 13, 14 and reading science fiction, I kept looking for the story where the girl saved the planet, for the story where the woman was the spaceship. And at the time that I was growing up, those stories just, you know, they just didn't exist, or at least I wasn't finding them. And I was asking teacher librarians, and they'd be like, well, this one has a girl in it. Be like, yes, but she's not really doing anything. And I love, you know, watching Star Trek. I love Lieutenant Uhura because she was smart and she did stuff that mattered, you know, and so she was definitely a hero. But I kind of wanted her to be there. So, so do I have a thing for, you know, making sure that strong women show up doing things that maybe they weren't doing when I was a teenager? Oh, heck yeah. That's a big one.
Great.
Writing those stories that I wish I could have found.
So you mentioned Own Voices Movement. Is there a website for that, or?
You know, there probably is. It would be part of the We Need Diverse Books, movement. And so Own Voices would be like a hashtag that you'll see on Twitter.
Oh, so it's a hashtag. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And perhaps more than a hashtag. That's how I think. Just looking at, you know, voices that have perhaps been marginalized, that we might not have as much awareness of as some voices we're more aware of than other ones. So, you know.
Anyway. Yep. There it is. I Googled our own voices and I couldn't find anything. But if you do the hashtag own voices, you'll find it.
Yeah. And there's some fantastic stuff coming to the attention of agents and editors, right? Because there's, you know, raised increased awareness and ability and the desire for these new materials coming from maybe people groups that have been marginalized in some way or other. So Yeah, mm-hmm. Exciting stuff.
That's great. Let's see. So, Darylinda, let me jump in again. Do you have some questions?
Okay. Well, I was just going to go back. sorry, I keep picking up a few things. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned your novella that turned into a novel that didn't work. I'm just wondering if you've ever faced like other challenges or, you know, maybe some specific challenges that have pushed you one way or another, or that, you know, when you're up against this thing that's just not working and it's feeling like, you know, as you said, you were having a lack of confidence, what keeps you writing through all of those?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I am not as happy a person when I'm not writing. Honestly, I swear that's what keeps me going some days. I know that if I don't write, I am not going to be a happy camper. So that in and of itself is motivation some days to just say, okay, you're going to sit down. You're not feeling at all capable today, but we're going to do a paragraph. Okay. Can we do a paragraph? Sure. I can knock out words. And sometimes that's what it, you know, that's what I need, just to kind of get things going. I definitely believe that the muse doesn't show up unless I show up, you know, to the extent that the muse pops in at all. it's because my butt is in my chair and my fingers are in the case on the keyboard. So yeah, I do believe in dogged persistence. I'm a huge believer in it.
When it comes to some of the world building and things like that, do you do a lot of backwriting on subjects to get those things straight in your mind, or do you push through that as you're writing?
Interesting question. I don't on purpose, but I do on accident a lot.
Uh-huh.
And this comes back to another deep-seated belief of mine, which is that there are no wasted words. So I may be writing a story and I end up with four or five chapters that just don't work for one reason or another. But chances are that there's been a lot of significant world building that's gone into that, or things that I explored that didn't work. Now I know that they don't work. So I definitely think there's no such thing as wasted writing, wasted words. Doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you have to write the wrong direction to figure out what, you know, where your true north is.
So what kind of tools do you use to write? And maybe some specific tools or resources or teachers that you've used and returned to in your writing. And
okay.
Maybe even, I know you do workshops sometimes.
Yeah. I love my friend, the thesaurus, love, 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 you know, synonym mm-hmm. finder, Rodale synonym finder. I type most of the time when I'm writing. Occasionally I will scribble something down on paper because I don't have anything else with me. But I prefer to type. I Microsoft Word. And then I, for like working on my iPad when I'm out and about, or my iPhone, I will use the app. Oh, what is it? It's the Word app. It became recently available. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, jump back and forth online, and then those can easily get imported back to my desktop where I do most of my writing.
So you're not choosing about what kind of keyboard you use?
Oh, well, I can't actually type on the iPad keyboard. I have one of those attachable keyboards. I think mm-hmm. it's like a Zag product maybe. I stand to type on a screen. It just makes me insane. So I want things clicking under my fingers. I'll jump around device to device for sure. Sure. Okay. And then in terms of, writing resources that I come back to again and again, there are two that I really like that are good for informing plotting and outlining. One of them is John Truby. I'm going to get the title wrong, but it's for sure got the phrase 22 steps as part of the title. John Truby, a phenomenal script doctor. So it's really geared towards script writing, but you know, I don't know any novelist who can't learn a lot from looking at screenwriting, how scripts are put together. So I go back to that again and again when I am maybe having trouble kind of working through, why is my character lying there flat on the page? Why isn't this character more interesting? And kind of the idea that you're looking for, you know, for the psychological and moral flaws that really do breathe life and error into your characters and then what we're looking for. And then another shorter work that I like is by Libby Hawker. And the book, it's got a hilarious title. It's called Take Off Your Pants. And she's addressing, you know, for those of us who love to write by the seat of our pants, sorry, you need to at least consider that maybe an outline might serve you well. She didn't say it like that, but she's a huge outline and provides a really sound structure that will work for lots of kinds of writing. So I kind of look at those when I'm feeling a little lost or trying to figure out, you know, what is the arc of this? Or go back to asking some of those basic questions that each of those books force you to ask.
Looks like the John Truby book is The Anatomy of Story, 22 Steps to Becoming a Master Storyteller.
Okay, well, that's the reason right there I couldn't remember the title. How many words is
that? Not quite 22 words. Yeah.
Yeah, love both of those.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen that one before, so that's a great resource.
Oh, yeah, check it out. Definitely it out.
When you're bouncing stuff between beta readers, do you use like Google Docs for that or like shared docs or anything, or you just send it out and then get...
Oh, I wish I were efficient enough to think that through ahead of time. I've never asked everybody to do one particular format, and I just email and Word docs. But I like what you're suggesting. That sounds smart. A person would do that.
I've done it with an email list before where, you know, I offer like a lot of different formats, but people always seem to like Google Docs, and it works because then they can start kind of like discussing between themselves, which is really interesting to see too.
Okay. So it shows up on the Google Docs as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is almost like an interesting kind of community building thing. I don't know. I've had weird conversations take place where, you know, and people, I haven't had to jump in and like moderate anything, but it's an interesting thing to see.
Yeah, sounds really organic and live. Nope, I don't do that.
You know, that kind of brings up for me. I know you already talked about kind of being a self-published, you know, the authorpreneur, I think is what Joanna Penn calls self-published authors. And you really seem to have taken hold of that. And then you are also a pretty prolific writer, and you've kind of built, you've talked in the past about, you know, you've built this team of editors and you know, you work with, you hire out, as you say, an editor and a, you know, book designer, I think. How do you manage the balance of that being, you know, a writer, the writer, you know, Sydney Swanson and author Sydney Swanson and managing the business side versus the writing side? Like how do you do that? And yeah. Because you're doing it very well. Look at how prolific you are.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very kind of you. Not some days well and some days less well. I mentioned that I've got this entrepreneurial strain in genetics that we don't know how it got there, but I think I enjoy both sides. And if I'm just running up against something that I cannot solve in my writing, it can be nice to step back and take a break and, you know, update my Twitter feed. I don't know. You know, it's, I like that back and forth between, okay, now I'm going to talk with my cover designer for this next book and we're going to go back and forth on color or, you know, what kind of titling we want. I really enjoy being able to step back. I think it is important as writers that we do something besides, you know, just write. I mean, what are we going to write about if we're keyboards all day? So for me, that's one thing that I can do. Violin is another one. Baking pies is another. I try to have things that I do that get me away from the keyboard as well as having my very rigid devotion to to a certain number of hours a day.
Now, you mentioned that you have kids and various animals. Actually, I think it was in the reverse. I liked how you say that in your thing. Assorted animals and children. How have you balanced that? Like, is there, you know, the sign on the door that says, you know, unless you need my kidney, you are not allowed to enter this room? Or are you writing at the dining room table as, you know, Mary Oliphant did and kids are running around you? How does that work for you?
I tried both. And, you know, I got enough of a hermit tendency that when I did have myself locked away in an office, it wasn't a really great thing for for any of us. Because I mean, I would just stay in there all day, poke my head out. Mm-hmm. So now my desk currently is kind of in the middle of everything. We have kind of an open kitchen family room area that's really a good size. And so I'm literally, I'm into a corner, but I'm in the middle of all three these spaces that uses the most. And there are times when I will kind of say, you know, I've really got to push through this scene, or I have to get this email out or whatever. And my family's great about it, you know, most of the time. And I try not to abuse that, because I really could be very happy, like I say, locked in that room that I used to do all my writing in. Never come out. Just slip some toast under the door and it's all good. So, but yeah, it wasn't a real healthy choice emotionally for being in.
Cindy, I think we've probably asked way more questions than we had anticipated, and because I could talk to you all day. This is so much good information, and it's so fun to talk to you. We like to end each interview with a little spot of inspiration for writers and who are striving to master their class or craft, I should say. What last piece of wisdom would you like to our writers, right, to leave our listeners with?
Yeah. You know, for me, it comes back to read, and write. Doing those two things in and of themselves will someday turn you into that writer that you want to be. You know, we read so that for fun, but we can also read for craft and for learning. I like to think of it like I actually did a Master Fine Arts program, which had me in a lot of drawing classes and things like that. And one of the things that you do, this is such a classical activity, any drawing class probably recognizes it. You know, you're looking at Albrecht Dürer's drawing of, or Michelangelo's, you know, some forearm that he's sketched, I think red crayon. And the assignment is copy this as precisely and as exactly as you can. Well, I kind of thought, I wonder if you could do that in writing. And so many years back, I started a practice of anytime I would find a sentence that was just absolutely delicious, you know, just chewy, yummy words put together so beautifully, I would then try to look at it and see it in the same way that I had seen that drawing of a hand, and in terms of how can I recreate this. And so then I would do practice sentences, you know, trying to look at what is it about the syntax or the construction of the sentence or the balance of, you know, adverbs or no adverbs or whatever. So I think that in the same way that a drawing student copies the master, that we could do that in practice. But primarily, you know, it's get those words down, practice every day, do some writing every day. There you go. That's my two cents.
That's amazing. And also, I had no idea you were an artist.
Well,
I mean, I knew you were an artist of words, but not on the not of art art as well.
It was in costume design. So, you know, it was just one of those things I did while I was busy avoiding being the writer that I really wanted to be. So,
wow.
It was rewarding.
Amazing. Yeah. All right. Well, how can our readers and adoring fans find you?
Well, I'm definitely, you know, on Twitter and Facebook and all that kind of stuff. And then in terms of finding the books, Amazon, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, everybody's got them as ebooks. There's at least two. I do have, for people who get their ebooks on Amazon, have a simple smart URL. It is smarturl.it/Sydney, C-I-D-N-E-Y. And that will pop up all of the titles that I have for sale on Amazon, at least. So
okay. Great. Sounds great. And also your website, did you say that?
Yes. Oh, sydneyswanson.com. So pretty simple.
Sounds great. Okay. Sydney, thank you so much. This has been such a delight to talk to you today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.